Today's episode of Court Junkie is brought to you by Universal Pictures' new film, The Snowman, based on the terrifying bestseller. I'm pretty excited for this one to come out, you guys. I watched the trailer and it looks absolutely thrilling. I'll include the link to the trailer in the show notes so that you guys can check it out too. The Snowman. See it only in theaters October 20th. Today's episode is also sponsored by Mindhunter, presenting the Netflix original series Mindhunter, starring Jonathan Groff and Holt McCallany. How do we get ahead of crazy if we don't know how crazy thinks? Two FBI agents set out on a sinister investigative odyssey, probing the depths of the killer's minds to discover the brutal answers and comprehend the motivations of killing. Mindhunter, October 13th, only on Netflix. Hey everyone, this is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 38. Today, I'm going to tell you about the case of the youngest person currently sitting on death row in Ohio. Austin Myers was 19 years old when he was found guilty and convicted of murder. But Austin's death sentence is considered controversial, with many advocates believing that his sentence should be changed to life in prison without parole. One of the reasons for this, as his trial will show, is that Austin himself never actually touched the murder weapon. And the guy who did got a lesser sentence in exchange for testifying against Austin. It was Monday, January 27th, 2014, in Waynesville, Ohio. Mark Cates, who worked at the Warren Correctional Institute, arrived home from work at his usual time of 3:30 p.m. As he pulled up, he noticed a 2003 silver Chevy Cavalier in the driveway. The rear windshield was missing, and it was instead covered in plastic with red tape. He had never seen the car before, but figured that it belonged to one of his stepson's friends who had come over to visit. Mark's stepson, 18-year-old Justin Back, was getting ready to leave for the United States Navy within the next 2 weeks, so a lot of his friends had been coming by to spend time with him before he left. Mark and his wife, Sandy Cates, had been married for 14 years, and between them had three kids, a son Mark had from his previous marriage, and Sandy's two sons from her previous marriage, Jacob and Justin. Mark's son lived with his mother, and Jacob was a United States Marine, so only Mark, Sandy, and Justin lived in the home on Corwin Drive in Waynesville. As Mark walked past the Cavalier, he noticed a Jeff Gordon sticker on the back bumper and formulated a joke in his head that he would make to whoever's car that was. But when he got inside the home, he realized that Justin had friends over whom he didn't recognize, so he refrained from telling his joke. Justin introduced him to the friends, Austin Myers and Austin's friend Tim, both of whom were 19. Justin told Mark that he knew Austin from years ago, from back in grade school, when they used to live by each other and ride the bus to school together. Mark made a sandwich and then sat down with the boys for a little bit as they watched a movie. But then Austin and Tim left, so Mark could take Justin to an appointment he had with his Navy recruiter. The next day, Mark again arrived home from work at 3:30. Here's testimony from the trial of Austin Myers, where Mark describes what he found when he got home that day.
Did you notice anything that appeared to be unusual to you when you arrived home that day?
Our dining room table was pushed up against the window on the right-hand side of the living or the kitchen, which is unusual, and there weren't any rugs. I didn't really think much about it because I thought maybe before Sandy had left for work, she may have done laundry and was washing the rugs or something like that. I rushed in, went straight back to the Ohio State room where we kept our files and stuff in a box and grabbed the information we needed for taxes.
All right, let's back up for a second. Before you got home on Tuesday, January 28th, you had some plans for what you were going to do after work.
Yes.
What were those plans?
I was headed to my brother's.
Prior to that,
After we did our taxes, okay. Yes. We were headed for taxes.
You say we were headed for taxes. Who was headed to do their taxes on Tuesday, January 28th?
Justin and I.
And where were you going to do those?
At the company that Sandy works for.
So you arrive home, you come in, you notice these items are missing. You go look for documents. Is Justin home?
No, he isn't. We'd been trying to call him and couldn't get through to him.
And this is at what time, approximately?
I'd been calling since I walked out of the prison.
So since 3 o'clock?
Yeah.
What did you do after you grabbed the documents?
Well, when I looked down, I saw his phone was laying on the love seat in that room.
In which room?
In the Ohio State room. So I called Sandy on my way to her office to tell her to stop trying to call him because his phone's here.
At that particular time, 3:30, quarter four on Tuesday, January 28th, do you have any concerns about Justin's whereabouts?
Not really at that time. A lot of times he would go run on the bike path. And on a rare occasion, he would forget his phone when he was doing something. He'd, get in a hurry to go get something to eat or whatever, and he'd just walk out without it, but it was a rare thing.
Mark left the house to go run some errands. He went to get his taxes done and then over to see his brother. He then went to a couple department stores looking for a going-away gift to get Justin.
When did you first start having concerns that something might have happened to Justin?
On my way home, Sandy had gotten home and called me, and she asked me if I had had issues in the kitchen with the table being pushed away and stuff like that. I said, no, I thought it was you. And I said, and I noticed the rugs are not there either. And that's when she went and checked the laundry and the bathtub in case maybe, something got spilled on them, and he had just taken them, put them in the tub to, so they wouldn't spill, stain anything. But when she didn't find them, she was kind of, confused and a little worried about what was going on. And I got home moments after that.
When Mark got into the house, he went to the bedroom he shared with his wife. He noticed that his nice watch that he usually wore on the days when he didn't go into work was missing. He asked Sandy if she had seen it, and she said no.
The watch is missing. Did you notice anything else missing? Before you get to the closet, you notice anything else is missing?
I noticed that there was some jewelry. There was a box that I remembered that sat on top of the dresser with it, and I didn't see it. I thought maybe she had been looking for a bracelet or something and moved it. And she said no, she hadn't. And so at that time, I came out of the room to see where she was at, and we noticed that the lamp in Justin's room was on the floor. It normally sits up on his dresser.
Did you do anything with the lamp?
I picked it up and set it back up on the dresser because with the lamp on the floor, you can't see in the room. There's not enough light. It's the only light in the room.
Plugged, I assume it's plugged into an outlet?
Yeah.
It's connected to a light switch?
Light switch, yeah.
In Justin's room, the lamp's on the floor. Where do you go next?
I go back into our bedroom, and that's when I looked in the closet and looked over to the closet and realized that the safe was gone.
Mark kept his badges, paperwork, and coin collections in the safe. But what was more alarming was that his 9mm gun was also missing, which was normally stored on top of the safe. Sandy went through the contacts in Justin's cell phone while Mark called 911.
Off his dresser, in the kitchen, the tables were all shoved up against the wall. The rugs are missing.
Try not to disturb anything until they get there. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
And most importantly, we're worried about our son. We can't find him now.
Mark called his next door neighbor, Andrew Raymond, to see if he had seen Justin that day or knew where he was. Andrew said he hadn't, but said that he had noticed a silver Chevy Cavalier backed up to the carport earlier that afternoon. He said the car's rear windshield was missing and covered with plastic and red tape. It was the same car that Mark had come home to the day before. Officers responded to the home, and shortly after, Mark and Sandy went to their neighbor's house while police conducted a deeper search of their home. And they wouldn't be allowed back inside their home until the next day, because what investigators would find in the house would lead them to believe that something more sinister than a burglary had happened. Officer Jason Roberts was one of the first officers to respond to the Cates home. At first, he was skeptical of what kind of call he was responding to. He thought that maybe this 18-year-old had a drug problem, had stolen from his house, and then left. But within minutes of being inside the home, he knew that something else was going on. Here's part of Officer Roberts' testimony from Austin's trial.
So right along when you walked in the house, was that kind of in the back of your mind?
Yes.
And did you start to ask questions or investigate to see if that was an accurate assessment?
I did.
Yes. And how did you go about doing that?
Well, after further investigating with Mr. Cates and kind of finding out a little bit more background on Mr. Back or on Justin, realized that we had a teenager that was about to graduate high school, had no criminal history, was well-liked. They didn't suspect him of any drug usage or anything like that. And this was kind of out of character for him to be gone for this period of time without a cell phone or any of his items and not make contact with them.
So did that kind of change your focus of the investigation?
Yes.
All right. Did you walk through the house?
I did.
And was your attention directed to any specific areas of the house or items in the house?
Yes, when we walked in, Mr. and Mrs. Cates explained that they came in through the back door and started to notice some things were out of place. They noticed in the kitchen a table had been pushed up against the wall, and from where they had just replaced the flooring in the kitchen, they had two rugs in that area, or in the kitchen area, that were missing.
And do you visually confirm that what they were reporting to you?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What about in the living room area of the house?
The living room... whenever I entered the residence, there was a rocking chair that I remember Mr. Cates specifically said that they noticed this right away because this rocking chair was never moved, very seldom used. The rocking chair was turned an opposite way. There was a small, about the size of a baseball or softball, pink to light pink stain on the floor in front of the rocking chair, and also the same type of stain on the carpet entering the kitchen that Mr. Cates noticed and pointed out that said that was not there yesterday.
The pinkish stains made him concerned as to where Justin was. The stains looked like they could be blood that someone had attempted to clean. Officer Roberts spoke with the next-door neighbor, Andrew Raymond, who again relayed the information about the suspicious car he had noticed in the Cates driveway earlier that afternoon. Mark Cates was able to remember the name of the boys who were with the car just the day prior, Austin Myers and his friend Tim. Investigators put out a Be on the Lookout, or BOLO, for the Silver Cavalier, as well as for Austin Myers. Within hours, police had caught up to both Austin Myers and Tim, as well as a third person, a friend of Austin and Tim's, named Logan Zenny. All three guys were interviewed, and it wasn't long before the story of what happened to Justin Back started to unfold. Logan told police that Tim had given him items to keep in a safe at his house, but he didn't know much more than that. Tim, however, admitted to police that he and Austin had in fact killed Justin Back. And then he told them where they could find Justin's body. The investigation had stretched into the early morning hours now. Based on information from Tim, whose full name was Tim Mosley, investigators went to a neighboring county, to an area known as Crybaby Bridge. And sure enough, Justin's body was there, lying on the cold, freezing ground, wrapped in a blanket, and covered in a white, powdery substance. Shell casings were found next to the body, along with a box of septic tank cleaner. Austin Myers and Tim Mosley were both arrested and charged with 9 counts, including aggravated murder with prior calculation and design, aggravated murder, kidnapping, aggravated robbery, aggravated burglary, theft of a firearm, tampering with evidence, safe-cracking, and abuse of a corpse. Both men pleaded not guilty, but not before news of their confessions made the rounds in the local media. Both men had spoken with police in the hours after they were first apprehended. Tim told them that he and Austin had plotted to kill Justin Back with a garrote, or choking device, in order to rob a safe that was kept in the Kate's home. The plan was to then dump the body and make it look like Justin had run away. But something had gone horribly wrong, and Tim said he ended up taking out his knife and stabbing Justin to death. Austin claimed less responsibility. He told police that it was all Tim's idea, that he had no knowledge beforehand that any of this was going to happen. Later, he admitted to being in on it, but said that he had wanted to purchase the garrote, quote, just to choke him to unconsciousness, not to kill him. So there they were, Austin and Tim, two friends who now stood accused of the most heinous crime and who were now facing the death penalty. But just 1 week prior to heading to trial, Tim Mosley, who had reportedly confessed to being the one to actually kill Justin, took a plea deal, accepting a life without parole prison sentence in exchange for testifying against his now former friend, Austin. Austin's trial began on September 24, 2014. In his opening statements, prosecutor David Forschnell started by saying that Austin Myers, quote, chose to kill. He pointed out that there were opportunities to commit burglary while no one was home, but that instead, Austin targeted Justin Back. He called Justin a normal teenager who lived with his mom and stepdad. He had graduated from Waynesville High School in 2013 and had recently decided to continue his career in the Navy, leaving in February. He liked to stay up late, play video games, and watch movies. Very much like any other 18-year-old you would know, Forschnell said. Forschnell told the jury that Justin would still call and ask for permission to go somewhere, or would call and let his parents know where he was going. Which was why, when they didn't hear from him on that Tuesday, January 28th, they became so concerned. We don't know why Austin targeted Justin, Forschnell said. They had known each other when they were younger, when Austin used to live in the area behind Justin's house. But by all accounts, they didn't talk anymore after that. But that all changed on January 27th and 28th. Prosecutor Forschnell said that Austin and Tim had made numerous trips to various stores both the day before and after the murder. On the 27th, video surveillance shows them trying to buy three boxes of PM cold medicine from a store in Waynesville called Hometown Marketplace and syringes from Waynesville Pharmacy. Later, they're captured on video at Lowe's, purchasing a 3-foot piece of wire and two handles, materials used to make a garrote, or choking device. Then, on Tuesday the 28th, they're seen on video at a Dollar General store in Dayton, purchasing septic tank cleaner, ammonia, and plastic gloves. And shortly after 1 p.m. that day, surveillance video picks up the Chevy Cavalier driving in the direction of Justin Back's house. Prosecutors estimated that Justin Back was murdered between 1 and 2 p.m., he said. Forschnell then detailed the murder, saying that the garrote they attempted to use on Justin didn't work. It got caught on Justin's chin. So there was a struggle for several minutes until Tim pulled out a pocket knife and stabbed Justin in the back, stomach, and chest. At 18 years of age and 2 weeks from leaving for the Navy, Forschnell said, Justin bleeds out and dies on his own kitchen floor. After the murder, Austin and Tim went into cleanup mode, using materials they had purchased from Dollar General. They cleaned up the kitchen floor, wrapped Justin's body in a blanket, and dumped it in the back of the Cavalier. They then tried to make it look like Justin had taken items from the house and had run off. They took the safe, his laptop, shoes, and Beats headphones, among other things. Tim was familiar with a remote area in Preble County called Crybaby Bridge, and so Austin and Tim decided to dump Justin's body there, Afterwards, they went north to Golden Gate Park, where they dumped Justin's laptop, and then to Joe's Hillcrest Tavern, where they disposed of his iPod. A couple weeks after Justin's body was found, detectives went back out to the area to search for more evidence. By that time, the snow had finally melted, and they found the garage near where Justin's body had been found. Prosecutor Fornshell then addressed how Austin had first blamed Tim, then said that they had wanted to choke Justin, not kill him, and how after that, when speaking to other people, Austin said that he had multiple alibis for that day, and that he thinks someone else went there with Tim. He claimed he never went to any of those places and never went back to Waynesville after first visiting Justin on the 27th. Prosecutor Fornshell told the jury that Austin could have waited 2 weeks until Justin left for the Navy to rob them, if that was really the motive. No one would have been home during the day, and Austin knew that. But for some reason, it was about more than just a burglary. He chose to kill, he said. When it came time for the defense to give their opening statement, they declined, saying that they would rather give their opening statement before the beginning of their case, and the judge granted that request. Mark Cates, Justin's stepfather, was the first witness to take the stand. He said that Justin was supposed to leave for the Navy just 10 days from the date of the murder. He said Justin had saved up his money so he wouldn't have to work until the day he left. So as a result, he would wake up in the afternoon, watch movies or play video games, and go hang out with friends. Mark said he was trying to get every video game he had beaten before he left. He said that once police released their house back to them and repairs were made, he and his wife realized that more items were missing from their home, including Mark's bank debit card, more jewelry, and watches. Deputy Sheriff John Michael Smith testified that when he did a walkthrough of the Cates home, he used Blue Star, a chemical agent similar to luminol, to do a preliminary test for blood. He said he found that there were bloodstains by a rocking chair in the living room, at the threshold in the kitchen and hallway, on the kitchen floor, on the bottom panel of the refrigerator, and on one of the doors leading to the utility room. A cleanup had been attempted, and there were swipe marks found. Sergeant Joseph Houndshell with the Warren County Sheriff's Office testified that when he learned that investigators had found the Chevy Cavalier along with Austin Myers, he responded to a home that turned out to be Tim Mosley's in Clayton, Ohio. When he pulled up, the Cavalier was in the driveway, and two Clayton police officers were watching it. Austin, Tim, and Logan Zenny were all being interviewed. At some point, Tim had asked again to speak with a detective, and so he was interviewed again. As a result of that interview, Sergeant Houndshell said he went to Logan Zenny's house, approximately a quarter mile away from Tim's. Logan and some other officers accompanied him. When they got to Logan's bedroom, Sergeant Houndshell saw that there was a safe laying on the floor. Inside was property that had been taken from the Cates home, including a backpack, Beats headphones, a watch, coins, cameras, sunglasses, a knife, and a firearm. The state's next witness was Tim Mosley, and we'll get into that testimony right after this quick break from our sponsors. You may have seen me post about it on my Instagram. Virtue Labs is a new hair care brand with a goal of giving everyone the best hair scientifically possible. Complete with alpha-keratin 60KU, a whole human protein that's identical to the keratin in your own hair, Virtue Labs hair products have the power to resurface and fill in cracks from damage to change your hair's quality and appearance forever. That means more bounce, more shine, more strength, and more life for your hair. Here's how it all started. This incredible new protein, alpha-keratin 60KU, was discovered 6 years ago by a group of bioscientists working in restorative medicine. And now, you can only find it in Virtue Labs' line of shampoos, conditioners, and styling products. But the really cool thing is that each Virtue Labs product is formulated to address specific issues, like heat damage, frizz, or thinning hair. And in clinical testing, Virtue found a 67% reduction in frizz after 4 washes and a 95% reparation of split ends after 5 applications. So if you're ready to experience it, Court Junkie listeners can now try Virtue at 10% off and get free shipping with the code COURT. Visit virtuelabs.com to place your order. It's time to start treating our hair with a little more humanity. It's time for Virtue. I'm excited to tell you that this episode is also sponsored by Elevest. There are 2 things you probably hate doing: waiting and losing. Well, if you're a woman and you're not investing, you are doing both right now. You could actually be losing about $100 a day by waiting to invest. It's like a crisp new Benjamin flying out the window every day. But I have some good news. Elevest is an online investment platform for women where you can invest in specific life goals, such as buying a house, starting a business, or retiring your way on your terms. Elevest gives you a free, customized financial plan based on goals you choose, shows you how much to invest every month until you reach those goals, and sets up recurring deposits to help you stay on track. All you have to do is get started. And now, my listeners will receive $100 towards your first funded goal when you sign up with Elevest. Visit elevest.com/court. That's ELLEVEST.com/court. Tim Mosley took the stand and testified that in January 2014, he drove a silver 2003 Chevy Cavalier that had belonged to his mom's boyfriend. He said he's known Austin for a couple years. They met while in school and through mutual friends. They had classes together and hung out outside of school, too. Prior to January 27th, Tim said that he didn't know who Justin was and didn't know his family. On the morning of January 27th, he said he had slept over at their friend Logan Zenny's house and that Austin had been living with Logan and his family at the time. He said when he woke up, he was supposed to take Austin to a work orientation, but they had overslept. So instead, Austin asked him if he wanted to make some money, and Tim said yes.
He brought up two scenarios, one of them being which we'd go to the supposedly drug dealer's house, lives alone, pretty much has a bunch of money, guns, grows his own marijuana, and he said that he's never home, so it sounded like an easy job to do. And then he also brought up Justin Beck's stepdad, Mike, saying that he had a safe that usually has it cracked open, told me about his the gun that he had, and pretty much get in, get out, grab the safe and money, the gun, anything we could to sell.
Now, he references Justin Back at that point in time. Is that the first time that you had heard Austin talk about Justin Back?
Yes.
They headed out in Tim's car, with Austin giving him directions. At first, he thought they were going to the drug dealer's house, but then he realized when they approached the Waynesville area that they were going to Justin's house. They arrived around 12 p.m. Justin answered the door and was surprised to see them there. He told them that he had been sleeping. They went inside and sat on the couches in the living room. Austin and Tim kept texting back and forth, trying to figure out a plan since Justin was home. Austin told Justin that they were going to go by his mom's house and that they would be back later. Tim said they were only there for about 15 minutes. Tim and Austin then went to the Waynesville library so they could get hot chocolate and talk privately about their plans.
What did you talk about at the library?
Different scenario plan to come up with, and in order to get the money. And Austin came up with the idea of killing Justin Beck.
All right. Was there any discussion of how you were going to do this?
We came up with the idea of buying some cold medicine and syringes, filling it up with the cold medicine and injecting Justin Beck.
After you come up with this plan, whose idea was the cold medicine?
Mine.
All right. After you come up with this plan to do this, did you undertake any efforts, either you or Austin, to acquire the cold medicine or the syringes?
Yes.
He said they went to a store called Hometown Marketplace to pick up the cold medicine. The cashier was suspicious of why they needed so much, and Tim said Austin told her that both of their families were ill. But before they could purchase their items, their card kept getting declined, and so they left. They then went to Waynesville Pharmacy to pick up syringes, but the pharmacy was busy, so they left there too. They then went back to Justin's house. He was watching a movie at that point, so they came in and just started talking to him. Justin was telling them about how he was joining the Navy. Tim recalled Mark Cates coming home, and so they left when Justin told them that he needed to go to his recruiter appointment. Austin and Tim then went to McDonald's in Waynesville. They were sitting in the parking lot, talking about what to do. Tim said he came up with an idea to go break into the house after Mark and Justin left and to get the safe then. But Austin said no, because they didn't know where their meeting was and what sort of time frame they had. They drove past the house again to scout it out and then got back onto the highway. They went back to Tim's house and two of their other friends, Logan and Cole, came over. Austin and Tim gave Logan and Cole an excuse so they could sneak away upstairs and talk privately about what they were going to do. Tim said that as they discussed their plan, he wrote down their ideas in a notebook. He said what they decided to do was to strangle Justin and then make it look like he had run away. The notebook was shown to the jury. On the top was a list that read, crowbar, wire, duct tape, strangle. Underneath that list, there was an arrow with another list. No mess. Take clothes, money, computer, and charger. Disappear. State, figure as we go. Woods, no public. Wrap up in blanket. Tim told the jury that the notebook accurately depicted their plans to kill Justin. While talking upstairs, Tim said that Austin came up with the idea of killing Mark Cates also, and making it look like Mark had killed Justin and then took the safe and ran off with it. Tim said he told Austin that it was a bad idea. It was more work to do and was riskier. After they finalized their plans, Austin came up with an excuse to borrow $20 from Logan, telling him that he was using it for a lucrative drug deal. They then went to Lowe's and bought wire and two grips or handles for the choking device. When they got back to Tim's house, Logan and Cole were still over. Tim said he and Austin tried to put the garrote together, but had problems. Logan came upstairs and saw what they were doing, but didn't know what they needed it for. Logan helped them construct it. The next day, on the morning of Tuesday, January 28th, Tim and Austin went to Dollar General to pick up some extra supplies they would need in order to kill Justin. They purchased plastic gloves, ammonia, and septic tank cleaner. When asked why they got the septic tank cleaner, Tim replied that Austin said that cold weather would preserve the body, so they needed the enzymes to pour on the body in order to make it decompose faster. They drove past Justin's house a few times before finally deciding to go for it. As they walked into Justin's house that day, the plan was for Austin to distract him, and Tim would then approach him from behind and strangle him while Austin held him down. They knocked on the door and Justin let them in. They sat down in the living room and Justin asked them if they wanted something to drink. Tim said no, but Austin said yes. Justin told Austin where the drinks were located and Austin pretended like he couldn't find them, so they both went into the kitchen. The choke wire was in Tim's pocket.
Tell me what happens in the kitchen.
Justin opened up the fridge, and that's when I saw the opportunity, and I followed him as he was coming, bending, straining himself out from bending over, grabbing the pop. That's when I threw the choke wire, the garrote, around Justin.
All right. So you say, as he's straightening out, he leans over to do what? He being Justin.
To grab the pot.
And then you throw the garrote or the choke wire. You're behind him?
Yes.
And you throw it over him at what point?
When he was straightening himself up.
As he's straightening up.
Yeah.
Tell me what happens after you try to put it over his head.
As soon as I got it around him, I pulled back and crossed my arms. And at that precise moment, Austin came in and grabbed Justin back to restrain him.
You say you crossed your arms. Did you switch the handle in your hands?
No, sir.
Okay. So when you say crossed your arms, you mean like this?
Yes.
In an X motion?
Yes.
Okay. You said Austin, at that point in time, grabs him.
Yes.
Why does he grab him?
To restrain him.
What happens next?
I kick Justin's feet from under him. We all three of us fall to the ground. We got into an entanglement. And at that moment, it was Justin on top of Austin, on top of me.
You're on the bottom.
Yes.
Okay. I hesitate to use the word conversation, but what's the conversation at this point in time?
At first it was minimal conversation. If any, as we were, obviously Justin was trying to put up a fight, and just he wasn't overpowering us, and so that a few moments after, Justin was trying to ask us why he was pleading to stop, and pretty much begging for his life.
Tim said Austin told him that he had missed his throat, that the wire was wrapped around his chin. They were all struggling on the ground at this point.
You said that Justin was asking why?
Yes.
How many times does he make these statements?
Multiple times.
Did you respond?
No.
Did Austin respond?
He did.
What did Austin say in response to these questions and statements that Justin Back is making as he's attempting to kill him?
In the lines of, it's all right, it's almost over, just on the lines of trying to calm him down, I suppose.
Tim said the struggle lasted a good couple minutes on the kitchen floor, but they weren't able to kill him.
What happens next?
Austin told me that the garrote was around his chin and not his throat, and that's pretty much when I panicked.
Tell me what happens.
Through the panicking in the fight, I pulled out my knife and started to stab Justin in the back.
What kind of knife was this?
Just, let's say, 5-6 inch pocket knife.
Did you stab him anywhere else?
I did.
Where did you stab him?
Somewhere after stabbing him in the back and through the fight and the entanglement, Austin got a hold of the garrote, and he was on his back against the wall with Justin in his lap. And the garrote was around his throat, and that's when I was stabbing him in the chest, torso area.
What's Austin doing at this time while you're stabbing him in the torso area?
He has the garrote around his neck.
Is he pulling it? Is he? Can you tell what he's doing with it?
He's pulling on it.
What happens next?
After I stabbed him, I put the knife down. I was pretty much freaked out and panicked. I put the knife down, took off my gloves. My hands got cut.
Are these rubber gloves at this point?
No, it's just my winter gloves that I had on. And when I had to go out in my hands and cross the wire, cut my hand and on both hands, so my hands was bleeding. So I took the gloves off, was trying to get it to stop bleeding, and that's when I put rubber gloves on, made sure my shoes didn't track any blood, and I walked to the front room, looked out the window, just to see if there was anything going on outside.
When you say see if anything's going on outside, why are you doing that?
Just in case for some reason somebody comes home, just to see if there was anybody approaching the house.
Tim said he and Austin then went to Justin's parents' room looking for the safe. They retrieved it from the closet, along with a gun case with a 9mm inside. He said Justin was lying on his back on the kitchen floor, and there was blood everywhere. They cleaned up the house. They grabbed the floor mats in the kitchen and used them to soak up the blood. They then went and grabbed a bunch of Justin's things so they can try to make it look like he had run away. After they cleaned up, they grabbed the blanket from the couch and wrapped it around Justin's body. They then dumped him into the trunk and loaded up the car. They drove around for a while with Justin's body in the trunk. At one point, they stopped and Austin got Justin's wallet, which had about $100 in cash in it, from the back seat. They went back to Tim's house, where they changed their clothes and hid the items they had stolen in Tim's bedroom. They then drove towards Crybaby Bridge, where Tim had suggested they get rid of the body. They stopped at a gas station and, using Justin's money, they purchased gas, beef jerky, and multiple energy drinks. When they got to their destination, they put gloves on and moved the body from the trunk to the ground, placing it behind a giant log. They then grabbed the bag of chemicals and ammonia, and Austin poured them over the body and the surrounding areas. Austin then said he wanted to shoot the body.
He wanted to shoot the body for whatever reason. And so I got into the, my car and got the gun and then handed it off to him. I was about maybe 10, 15 feet away from him. And he was standing over Justin's body and continued to shoot him.
How many times did he shoot him?
Twice.
How many times did he try to shoot him?
Three times.
Tell me what happened on the... Did it work the first time and not the first two times and not the last one, or how was the sequence?
After the first shot, I'm trying to get out of it. It was loud. The gunshot was loud. He continued to shoot him a second time. I'm just like, we got to get out of here. Let's go. He went to shoot him a third time, and the gun jammed. So he ejected he tried and then successfully discarded the jammed bullet.
Did you see the discarded bullet that he was able to eject?
Yes.
Did you and Austin have any conversations about that?
I watched it hit the ground, and he said that it had Mark's fingerprints on it, so we just left it.
He said they again talked about going back and killing Justin's stepdad as well, but they again abandoned that plan because Tim said that it was a bad idea. They drove around for a little bit and dumped Justin's laptop in a dumpster near Golden Gate Park. And then they stopped at a tavern and taped Justin's iPod to someone's car that was in the parking lot. They went back to Tim's house and Austin cracked open the safe from the Kate's home. Tim said there was paperwork, loose change, gun accessories, bullets, and random items in there. Not at all what they had been expecting. He said Austin had initially told them that there would be about $20,000 cash inside. They took the bags of evidence, the towels, the rugs, what they had used to clean up the blood at Justin's house, and burned them in the fire pit in Tim's backyard. Tim's mom and her boyfriend had come home by this time and were eating dinner while the boys were doing this. Austin told them that he was burning his ex-girlfriend's stuff. They then decided to get rid of the safe, so they loaded it into the car, along with other items they were planning on selling. They went to Logan Zenny's house and gave him those items to put into his safe in his room. From there, the three of them went to dispose of the safe from the Cates home. They went to the river and threw it in. They then went back to Tim's house, and that's when he got a phone call that the cops were on the way. He tried to clean out his car really quickly, tossing items into a laundry basket and then into the garage. Within minutes, the police arrived. The prosecutor had one last question for Tim.
Mr. Mosley, when you arrived at Justin Back's house on Tuesday afternoon, January the 28th, did you have an intention of stabbing Justin Back to death?
No.
Did Austin Myers know that you were going to stab him that day?
No.
What specifically was your intention with respect to Justin Back, and by your, I mean yours and Austin Myers' intention with respect to Justin Back that day?
Just to strangle him and kill him in a clean way.
And dump his body.
And dump his body.
Your Honor, I have no further questions.
Detective Mike Wyatt from the Warren County Sheriff's Office testified that he attended Justin Back's autopsy on January 31st. He said the medical examiner told him that two rounds had entered Justin's body. One round was found inside the body, and the other was likely still at the scene where Justin had been found. So Detective Wyatt and some other detectives went back to Crybaby Bridge. But instead of finding the spent round, they found a live one, which would corroborate Tim's testimony that Austin had tried to shoot Justin's body three times, but the gun had misfired. Detective Wyatt told the jury that after Austin was arrested, he was taken to Warren County Jail, where any phone calls he made were recorded. Prosecutors introduced four phone calls into evidence that Austin had made to his father. In one of the calls, he tells his father that he hasn't done anything illegal. And in another call, he says that he never went to Justin's house that day and that he has multiple alibis and multiple people who he was with. Detective Wyatt went to Tim's house just before the trial had started on September 20th, 2014. Tim had told him that he had a notebook in his room that detailed their plans to kill Justin, so Detective Wyatt went to retrieve it. Erin Snowden, a social studies teacher at Northmont High School, testified that she knew both Austin and Tim from school. She said both were in a program at the school called BEAT, which was meant for students who are unsuccessful in their classrooms due to behavioral issues. Ms. Snowden said that Austin wrote numerous papers for her in class. In February 2014, about a month after his arrest, she received a letter at the school from Austin, whose handwriting she recognized right away. She said she had seen what happened in the news, and so she was surprised that he was writing to her. She said it made her uncomfortable, and she freaked out a little bit, so she turned the letter over to her school resource officer. The contents of the letter were not allowed in front of the jury. Two store managers, one from Lowe's, George Worrell, and one from Dollar General, Alicia Dietrich, testified about the purchases made by Austin and Tim leading up to the murder. Surveillance video was played for the jury of Austin and Tim purchasing the steel cable and two handles from Lowe's on the evening of January 27th. In the video, Austin is the one purchasing the items. Alicia Dietrich said that the morning of January 28th, Austin and Tim came in and purchased the ammonia, septic tank cleaner, and gloves. She identified Austin as the person who paid. A man named Dustin Kuntz took the stand and recalled how he was helping jumpstart a neighbor's car on January 29, 2014, when he noticed something wrapped in red tape on his windshield between the window and the hood. He saw that it was an iPod, and in the notes, there was a name on it, Justin Back. He said after telling his wife about it, he contacted police. Mark Purdy, a deputy sheriff at the Warren County Sheriff's Office, and member of the crime scene unit, testified that on the morning of January 29th, he and some other investigators from the crime scene unit executed a search warrant on Tim Mosley's home in Clayton, Ohio. Photos of what he found were shown to the jury and included the following. Footprints leading to a fire pit in the back of the home where parts of a towel were recovered from the ashes. A wood pile near the fire pit with one or two logs missing. A laundry basket in the garage that contained blue jeans that had been crumpled up and that had dried red suspected blood on them. A pry bar, a gun lock used to secure a semi-automatic firearm, a white netting bag with gun accessories and ammunition, a debit card for Justin M. Back, a debit card for Mark Cates, and packages of beef jerky. Thomas Namovsky, a detective with the Warren County Sheriff's Office, testified that he responded to Tim Mosley's house as well in the early morning hours of January 29th. He said he did a walkthrough of the residence and didn't see anything suspicious in plain sight. However, when he looked at the Chevy Cavalier parked in the driveway, he noticed what looked like blood and tissue on the outside of the trunk of the car. He quickly opened the trunk to make sure a body wasn't inside before the car was towed. Detective Jay Henning testified that while Tim's house was being searched, he went to Logan Zenny's house, which was about 4 minutes away. Logan took him to where the items that Tim and Austin had given him to hold onto were, which included a small red duffel bag with coins, glasses, a watch, camera, and headphones, along with a 9mm semi-automatic handgun in a plastic case. And then detectives testified about finding Justin's body. Detective Robert Schneider, with the Preble County Sheriff's Office, said that they received information from the Warren County Sheriff's Department that there may be a body near Crybaby Bridge. He responded to the area, saw some tire tracks, and followed them. He then saw some footprints leading from the tire tracks into a field. He described finding Justin's body.
We stopped there before we walked into the shoe prints, and one of the deputies that was with me, Deputy Stevenson, said, "Look, I see something on that down tree," and she kind of pointed over the down tree.
What did you observe when you looked at the tree she'd pointed out?
I couldn't tell what it was. It looked like a blanket, kind of balled up. So I actually walked around the feet print so that I wouldn't disturb anything in case it was evidence. And when I got over to the down tree, I looked, and it was a quilt. And then kind of over the down tree, I could see the part of a body, and I looked and could tell that it was a white male, a younger white male, face down in the snow, face kind of turned sideways, but his face was over the log, face in the snow, and then, like I said, the part we could see from that path or from that field was his legs covered by a quilt.
Did you make any efforts at that point to determine if he was dead or alive?
I looked and I could tell that it was a deceased, that he was deceased at that time.
A photo of Justin's body was shown to the jury, the septic tank cleaner from Dollar General nearby. Deputy Andrew Grossenbaugh with the Warren County Sheriff's Office testified that he got a call that the body had been located in a field by Crybaby Bridge. He went to the location and saw that the body was wrapped in a blanket, and there was a brownish-grayish powder on the blanket and on the body. There were dark spots of blood in the snow, along with a yellowish liquid substance. Grossenbaugh said he thought that it was possible body material, like saliva. They attempted to preserve the tire prints and footprints by casting them, but due to the extreme cold weather, were unable to do it. Chris Munchiro, a forensic firearm and tool mark examiner from the Miami Valley Crime Laboratory, testified that the casings found at the scene, along with the bullet recovered from Justin's body, were a match to the 9mm gun found in the case, that they were all fired from the same firearm. Mary Sisko, a forensic scientist, testified about the blood and DNA evidence in the case. She said she took DNA samples from Austin, Tim, Mark Cates, Sandy Cates, Logan Zenny, and Justin Back to compare to the evidence that was found. She concluded that the blood found in the Cates living room, as well as in the inside of the Cavalier trunk, were partial mixed profiles. The major male components matched Justin Back, and the minor components were unable to be determined. The blood found on the kitchen floor, on the jeans found in the laundry basket in Tim's garage, and the blood collected from the outside of the Cavalier all matched Justin. Sisko also testified that the greenish-yellow substance that was found by Justin's body matched Austin. As for the garrote, Justin's blood was also found on the wire. However, the DNA on the handles was mixed, but neither Justin nor Austin could be excluded as a minor component. But on cross-examination, Sisko agreed that if someone had been wearing gloves, she wouldn't necessarily pick up their DNA, because the gloves would be a barrier between their skin and the item. Sandy Cates, Justin's mom and Mark's wife, told the jury that prior to January 28th, she did know who Austin Myers was. She said Austin and Justin were friends in eighth grade, but hadn't spoken to each other in a while. She said that one time, when they were younger, Justin spent the night at Austin's house, but she said things happened that made her uncomfortable. She allowed Austin to sleep over at their house once after that and said that, again, things happened that made her uncomfortable, so she told Justin that he couldn't hang out with Austin again. She hadn't seen or heard Justin talk about him since. She recalled the last time she saw her son on January 27th. She called him happy-go-lucky Justin and said that after he got home from his recruiting appointment with Mark, they ate dinner, watched The Big Bang Theory, and then Justin went to play video games. The next night, she came home from work to a dark house, which she said was unusual. She told the jury that Justin only really wore two pairs of shoes, his work boots, and, quote, hideous white Pumas that she hated, that he wore every single day. Both pairs of shoes were still in the house. Detectives told her at about 11 a.m. on January 29th that her son was dead. The state's last witness was Brian Casto, the deputy coroner with the Montgomery County Coroner's Office in Dayton. He conducted the autopsy on Justin. He said they started the autopsy on January 30th, but couldn't complete it until the next day, due to Justin's body being in a frozen state. Casto told the jury that there were obvious signs of injury, ligature marks across the face and neck, along with numerous stab wounds and gunshot wounds. On top of Justin's clothing, there was an abundant amount of powder, which Casto said was an attempt to hasten decomposition. Casto said Justin had sustained linear ligature abrasion marks, two on his chin and three on his neck. Those would be consistent with someone attempting to strangle him with a rope, cord, or cable. If it had gone on uninterrupted, it would have caused his death, Casto noted. Justin had suffered approximately 21 stab wounds, causing major damage to his internal organs, his lungs, diaphragm, liver, kidney, esophagus, and trachea. Each knife wound that penetrated his organs would have been fatal if left untreated. Justin also suffered a large amount of blood loss. Casto noted that in Justin's chest cavity, there was just under 2 liters of blood, and he would normally expect to see between 5 and 6 liters in someone Justin's age. And finally, there were the gunshot wounds. Justin had been shot twice, although those wounds were post-mortem, meaning they were made after he was already dead. Casto told the jury that the gunshot wounds were yellowish and not red and bloody, which is how they would look had he been alive when shot. One shot exited the body and the other traveled through his neck and lodged just in front of the spine and back of the throat. Casto said he was able to recover that bullet during the autopsy. Justin also had defensive injuries on his fingers and hands, indicating that he had fought with his attackers. The toxicology results were negative. There were no drugs or alcohol found in his system. Casto concluded that the cause of death was multiple stab wounds, and the manner of death was homicide. The prosecution rested, and when it was the defense's turn to present their case, they told the judge that they wouldn't be presenting a case, that they would only be giving closing arguments. In the state's closing arguments, Prosecutor Fornshell started the same way he began, saying, quote, he chose to kill. He went through each of the charges and said that Austin made a series of choices and acted with prior calculation and design to cause the death of Justin Back. He said Austin selected Justin as his target and carried out his plan, and that's why we're here today. He pointed out that there were almost 2 days of planning the murder, and that if the purpose was to rob and steal, they passed thousands of businesses that would have made a better opportunity. But he said that Austin targeted Justin and chose to kill him. As Austin held him down, Tim Mosley choked and stabbed him to death. Then he said that after dumping Justin's body, Austin dumped the septic tank cleaner on it, spit on the ground, and fired 2 rounds into him. Now let's talk about Tim Mosley, he said, telling the jury that Tim was consistent and forthcoming with his, quote, almost chilling, accurate testimony. He said Tim's testimony is corroborated by the evidence, and that Tim was the one who had told them what they did on the days prior, which led investigators to be able to retrace their steps and find out what was purchased. Tim said that Austin shot the body, and although Austin had first denied it, he eventually admitted it. They forever thwarted Justin's plans of serving in the United States Navy, Fornshell said. He closed by saying that this was one of the most clear-cut cases of planning and design you'll ever see. In their closing arguments, defense attorney John Caspar said that it's the state's burden to prove their case and pointed out that it's not the quantity of evidence, but the quality of it. Tim is a liar, he said. He has a reason to save his own skin at this point. Caspar said the state has not met their burden in several respects, and that Austin Myers didn't kill. Tim Mosley killed. The jury deliberated for about 5 hours before finding Austin guilty of all charges against him. At his sentencing, Austin pleaded with the jury to spare his life, not for himself, but for his family.
I'm sorry that this happened. I know that doesn't bring Justin back, but I'm sorry. I hate for any family to go through such pain and suffering as this. If you choose for me to die, it's only going to cause more pain and suffering for another family. Not me. It won't hurt me. I won't feel anything. It's going to hurt more innocent people. The terrible events of this past January have caused more than enough pain already. If you kill me, it won't fix anything. It won't bring Justin back. It's only going to hurt more innocent people. I don't want to hurt people. So all I'm asking you for is a chance for me to become a better person.
But Austin's pleas didn't work with the jury, who recommended that he be sentenced to death. As the judge formally imposed that sentence, he told Austin, "You have no respect for death." Austin's sentence is currently being appealed to the Ohio Supreme Court, who could hear the case at some point this year. The decision they'll have to make is whether Austin should have received the same sentence as Tim, or if he is more culpable in the case, even though he was not the one who stabbed Justin Back. His attorneys are arguing that his sentence be reduced to life without parole. And meanwhile, Justin's parents have been working to change the system too, in the opposite direction. Justin's mother, Sandy Cates, worked with Ohio State Representative Ron Magg to work on a bill that would deal harsher punishments to those who commit aggravated murder in Ohio. In April 2016, House Bill 57, also known as Justin's Law, passed in the Ohio House of Representatives. The law would, quote, expand the eligibility for a judge to grant parole for offenders found guilty of aggravated murder. Currently, judges can grant parole after 20, 25, or 30 years, whereas House Bill 57 would add parole eligibility after 35, 40, 45, 50, or 55 years. The bill also broadens the list of aggravated circumstances under which murders committed, quote, purposely and with prior calculation and design, are classified as aggravated murders. The Ohio Senate has introduced the bill, but is yet to pass. And that's all for this episode. Let me know what you think. Was Austin's punishment fair, given that Tim Mosley was able to avoid the death penalty? What do you think the Ohio Supreme Court will decide? And what are your thoughts on the death penalty in general? Let me know by visiting my Facebook group at courtjunkie.com/Facebook. Find me on Twitter at courtjunkiepod, on Instagram at courtjunkie, or you can email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. I want to give an extra special thank you to Debbie Kilgore at the Warren County Common Pleas Court for supplying the audio from Austin's trial. She was nice enough to answer all my questions and went out of her way to make sure that I had the audio needed for this episode. I also want to thank my sponsors from today's show and give another shout out to Virtue Labs, which I really do love. As a reminder, Virtue Labs is a new hair care brand with a vision to give everyone the best hair scientifically possible via an incredible new protein called alpha keratin 60KU. Alpha keratin 60KU is a whole human protein that's identical to the keratin in your own hair. It was discovered 6 years ago by a group of bioscientists and has the ability to resurface and fill in cracks from damage, giving more bounce, shine, and strength to your hair. And now you can get it exclusively in Virtue Labs' line of shampoos, conditioners, and styling products. Just visit virtuelabs.com and use the code COURT to try Virtue at 10% off plus free shipping. And one last thing before I go. Just a reminder that if you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by visiting courtjunkie.com/support. This will redirect you to my Patreon page, where you can donate as little as $1 a month and get early ad-free access to Court Junkie episodes. That's courtjunkie.com/support. Thanks everyone for listening. Until next time.